Welcome to the Black Sparrow Media Internet Broadcast Network.
Everybody and welcome. You have tuned in to episode number 166 of the Linux in the Ham Shack podcast. What? You're looking at me. you're looking at me like I didn't do that well enough. Sorry.
Welcome to Linux in the Ham Shack.
Sunday.
That's where I was afraid he was going with that. I was like, oh, you're failing miserably.
Sorry. Anyway, I'm Russ, the host, K5TUX. We also have Cheryl, who sits across from me.
Hello, everyone.
And Rich, KD0RG.
Hola.
Hola. Welcome to Linux in the Ham Shack.
All right, excellent. So you're going to speak Spanish. Rich is going to speak German.
No, he's going to speak Swiss, which is a very specific sub-dialect of German.
Yeah, but I don't know it. So I'll say, willkommen zu Linux in der Hamschack.
Hey, we can get Fab on here to do that.
Yeah, that's true.
So anyway, let's move on. We've got some amateur radio topics. We've got great interview later on. We've got some Linux topics. We've got Linux in the Ham Shop topics. We've got feedback. We've got recipes. We've got all kinds of stuff going on tonight. Rich, tell us about some spy radio stuff.
Well, I ran across this from eHam. It was a link to this article here, and it's unidentified spy radio set. Well, it doesn't happen very often, but here we have a Cold War spy radio set of which the origin is a mystery to us. For this reason, we're asking for your help in identifying it. The set is described in Louis Mulstee's book, Wireless for the Warrior, Volume 4, as the French 1950s miniature. But recent research has revealed that it most likely is not French, but probably East European. The modular spy radio set consists of three small, identically sized metal boxes, each of which has a top lid and measures approximately 16.5 by 8.5 by 6 centimeters. A complete set consists of a mains power supply, a transmitter, and a receiver. At least two different versions of the set have been so far identified. And that comes from cryptomuseum.com. I think they're in the Netherlands, and they have a huge collection of crypto stuff. And I guess they came across this radio, and they need help identifying it. And I don't know if we have any Cold War warriors that were in Eastern Europe. But
I bet we have at least one that's listening.
There you go. At least, there you go.
Maybe go help out.
Maybe you can go help out. Exactly.
All right. Very cool. You can check that out at cryptomuseum.com. The link will be in the show notes. So we also have the next story. Victor Kilo, 0 Echo Kilo, has over 50,000 QSOs. This is the Heard Island de-expedition. You don't know this if you're not listening to us live, but right now, or actually perhaps a half an hour ago, Tom Medlin, W5KUB of the Amateur Radio Roundtable, was interviewing these folks live down in Heard Island, which is just north of Antarctica, which I guess everything is sort of north of there. But the reason that nobody is here listening to us right now live is because they're all over there listening to him now live, talk to the folks from Heard Island. But they have over 50,000 contacts from there. And actually, I checked on their website today, and they have almost 60,000 contacts going right now.
They are racking them up.
They are definitely racking them up, and they will be on the air down there in Heard Island until April the 10th, 2016. Quote, we're having a busy afternoon here on the high bands with lots of stations taking advantage of some weekend time to work us. Propagation has been quite good today, and we are trying to take advantage of that. It's been a blast operating here, and we will still have more than a week to go. Unquote. This came from dxcoffee.com, but the VK0EK The expedition is all over the intertubes and really not that hard to find if you want to get on this. I was trying to work them on 40 meters earlier before the show. They were coming in pretty weak. They were on 7.085 megahertz when I was trying to work them, and they were in a pile up like you wouldn't believe. They're obviously doing some good down there, so if you want to check out the de-expedition, they're working pretty much all the time. So check them out before they go off the air on April 10th.
You look at the pictures and of it down there, and you know it's cold, but they're all just having a great time. I mean, everybody down there, it looked like they're really having a good time.
All right, and I'll do this one more here because I found this one just before the show started.
Oh, this one's awesome.
New radio antenna avoids unwanted signals. This one's got like all kinds of physics and stuff in it, so it's pretty cool. A new, simpler, cheaper, and potentially more effective way to prevent radio antennas from picking up unwanted signals has been created by researchers in the U.S. The laws of electromagnetism work exactly the same way if you run time in the opposite direction. One logical consequence of this is that an antenna designed to broadcast at a certain radio frequency will also be very good at absorbing radiation at that frequency. This is problematic for broadcast radio antennas, which will absorb radiation that is bounced back from surrounding objects. Andrea Alou and colleagues at the University of Texas at Austin have developed a design based on the traditional leaky wave antenna, in which electromagnetic waves of certain frequencies couple to the space around the antenna and leak out as they travel along it. So, very cool. That came from the Southgate Amateur Radio Club. And with additional information from Physics World, which is where the original article came from, with a lot more description about how the antenna works and all that kind of cool stuff. So this sounds like a great thing for the future of amateur radio, for antennas that broadcast frequencies but aren't necessarily as affected by the interference from return signals on the same frequency path.
I think it'll probably increase the dB of most tri-band Yagis by 4 or 5.
Cool.
I mean, that's just a guess, but I mean, think of all that radiation that, you know, it goes off the driven element, and some of it gets bounced back off of the director, and that's not going to get, you know, absorbed anymore. It's just going to keep on going. So that's fantastic.
A way to increase gain with minimal effort or minimal reconfiguration of an antenna, plus, you know, reduce the effect of, you know, retransmitted radiation, only be a win, right?
A double win, a win-win.
It's a win-win. That's right.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. I love physics.
Physics is indeed pretty incredible. I took an online course at Coursera a few months ago where it was about Einstein's theory of relativity, and it talked about things like running time in reverse, and it's a very cool concept. It tends to be a bit mind-bending, though. I'm not sure average human beings are expected to understand these kind of things.
Probably not.
But that's what we've got for our amateur radio topic. So we're going to move into some Linux topics and some open source topics. So, Rich, talk to us about Linus Torvalds.
Well, Linux is turning 25. And so he was interviewed by IEEE.org, actually. I pulled out a couple of quotes here that I thought were interesting from the Q&A.
Are you going to try your
I was going to do it like this. If I had known what I know today, when I started, I would
pretty
never
sure
have
he's not from New Delhi. I'm just guessing he's not from Mumbai. Okay, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm not.
He is now. All right. He's from Finland, is that right?
That's my understanding.
If I had known, I'm not going to try. If I had known what I know today when I started, I would have never had the chutzpah to start writing my own operating system. You need a certain amount of naivete to think that you can do it, unquote. And then another one is, quote, there really were two notable transitions for me. One fairly early on in 1992, which was when I started taking other developers' patches without always rewriting them myself. And one much later when, after applying all the patches myself, was starting to be a big pain point, and I had to learn to really trust all the various sub-maintainers, unquote. You know, it's neat to see kind of the evolution, how things progress, and how you kind of got to, you know, let go a little bit, and how he kind of let go a little bit. And, you know, he still certainly sounds like he still runs the show over there, but obviously there are a lot of people contributing. And
well, the Linux kernel, as you know, is a benevolent dictatorship. All patches have to go through Linus.
Yes, I did know that. Yeah,
it's always interesting to hear from Linus because he's one of those guys who has no filter. I like people who have no filter.
That's right. I agree.
You can find out more about that interview at spectrum.ieee.org, and of course the link to that will be in the show notes. Moving on with some open source topics, we have some Flash topics, and I still haven't created a nice stinger for that yet, but I'm going to get around to it. I really will. Interestingly, speaking of stingers, I'm going to divert for a second. Never happened on the program.
Oh, no.
Jonathan Nitto asked about the stinger that's at the beginning of the show where it says, "Welcome to Black Sparrow Media," which is something I actually did myself, and that voices me, if it wasn't obvious already. But he wanted me to recreate it for him as a stinger for apparently some other project.
Cool.
I don't know where that will show up again, but I'm working on it. Okay, so that minimal diversion. Anyway, Flash topic. Ubuntu 16.04 LTS, Xenial Zerus, yeah, they're just getting weirder, has new features. Rich, do you want to talk about this, since you probably looked at them and I didn't?
A Xenial is constituting hospitality or relations between host and guest, and especially among the ancient Greeks. And then
nice Scrabble word.
A Zerus is an African ground squirrel. So we have a polite African ground squirrel.
I think I've hit a few of those on the road.
Wow. It's going to be 16.04. We're almost there, everybody, and it's going to be a long-term
support
release. So we can dump the 14.04 or whatever the old one is and jump up to 16.04. And there's, you know, Python 3.5, OpenSSH 7.2, Docker was upgraded to 1.1. And you can actually get, I don't think it's officially released yet, but you can... if you go to the link in the show notes, you can download ISOs. They're still betas, but the latest one is 25th of March. So, you know, they're getting there.
All right,
very cool.
And that's
a Flash topic. We're done.
Yep, we're done. And we have another Flash topic sort of along the same lines. Debian 8.4 has been released. This is the latest version of Stebian Juicy. Debian 8.4, which is the stable version, otherwise codenamed Jesse, has a new release. Fourth update of the stable distribution, Debian 8. It adds corrections for security problems to the stable release, along with a few adjustments for serious problems. You can find more information about that at debian.org. Link, of course, will be in the show notes. I didn't actually know they were going to put out new releases of Jesse since they've been working on Stretch. And actually putting out alpha releases of Stretch, but apparently they are still working on the stable release too, so that's good to know.
Yeah, I think when problems arise, they fix them, and it doesn't really affect too many people. If you got updates turned on, it gets updated automatically. But if you're gonna install Jesse on something, it's just nice because then you're not downloading more data than is what is actually on the DVD to begin with. So, it's just updated. So,
right. Debian is a rolling release. This is something we've talked about a long time ago and really hasn't brought up as a topic in a while. But as long as you're maintaining your updates, doing your app-gets updates and app-get dist upgrades and so
that's
on,
that's right.
You're staying current. This is basically for the installer ISO.
That's correct.
So if you want your Jesse in this starting... at a starting point of 8.4, they have released that.
And another little Flash topic here. Linux Gizmos is now Hacker Boards, but we still love Linux. So Linux Gizmos is a site that's been around. I've wandered around them a few times, a lot of single board computers, and it's news about stuff. The reason I put it in is because they moved away. Before they were Linux Gizmos, they were what? Something else. They were Linux devices, I think. Linux devices. And so they've moved away from the Linux name. And I don't know if it's a bad thing or a good thing or if it was just what they had to do. So just interesting, I thought.
I don't know anything about Linux Gizmos. It's not a site I've ever visited. But now that I'm aware of it, I might have to check it out.
It's a news site, and like I say, a lot of gadgets and gizmos and, tiny wireless rich comm runs Linux on Snapdragon 820. And, all these little boards and stuff.
SBCs are like a great topic. So
I guess my The reason I thought it was significant is because they moved away from the Linux name. They've taken, you know, even though all that stuff runs on Linux, but maybe they see a future that, I don't know.
I think anyway. They've broadened their scope to open source as opposed to Linux specific, and there's nothing wrong with that.
You're right. You're always right, Russ.
I'm not always right. And you were right in the middle of taking a drink. I know you were.
So we have another Flash topic.
Flash!
And I think we talked about this before, but I don't think you could pre-order at the time. So you can pre-order the Ubuntu tablet.
We have talked about the Ubuntu tablet, I think, in episode 163.
But you can actually buy it now.
Oh, now you can actually get one? You know what?
Well,
I still don't want one.
There's a buy button. And I'll run through the specs real quick of the 300-pound one. It's got a quad core at 1.5 gigahertz. 2 gigs of RAM, 16 gigs of, solid-state memory, and 11.2 is usable. You can expand your memory with an SD card, blah, 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 blah. It has Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, GPS, an 8-megapixel rear camera, and a 5-megapixel front camera, 10.1 capacitive touch screen. Woo! Deliveries will take place starting from the second half of April. Buy it now while they're hot.
All right, so moving on to our third segment for the evening. This is Linux in the Ham Shack. We have a story that was put in here by Rich about Northwest Digital Radio announcing the UDRC price and availability. So, Rich, go ahead and take this one.
Well, you know, Russ, there's been a lot of interest in the UDRC, Universal Digital Radio Controller, that Northwest Digital Radio showed at Microhams recently. And it turns out the UDRC will sell for $89.95, including a 3-foot HD15 male-to-male cable for direct connection to the Yaesu DR1-X repeater and a 6-foot mini DIN 6 cable to connect to a standard radio data port. It works with a Raspberry Pi 2 or 3, which is not included, but they're going to try to make them available for sale by the end of April, along with a downloadable image. Nice. All software is open source and will be available on GitHub at the product release. And this all came from the Northwest Digital Radio site, and I think it's cool. And I think, I don't know, maybe we have somebody who knows a little more about it.
I don't know. It's not me. Do we have somebody in the room who's listening or maybe who can talk here who has any idea about any of this stuff? Do we have maybe Kilo 7 Victor Echo?
Yeah, it's John from Northwest Digital Radio.
All right. Excellent. Well, I tell you what, we don't have this interview really lined out. What we're hoping is that you can take this little blurb about the UDRC and kind of run with it and tell us everything we ever wanted to know about it.
Tell us all the syrupy goodness.
We'll start from the very beginning. Yaesu came out with this smoking deal for getting a repeater, and the deal was send them $500 if you live in the United States, and they will ship you a brand spanking new repeater that does VHF or UHF, same unit. You can switch between VHF or UHF. It's fully synthesized. It's got a touch screen for setup. It can do up to 50 watts, but for 100% duty cycle, you need to keep it down around 20. That's common. Some people kind of got excited about that, but I've been working with a few different repeaters, and that's kind of true of any repeater. You don't run it full bore. You put an external amplifier on it if you need more power. Anyway, that $500 got you the repeater. It covered the tax and the shipping, so it was a flat $500. Well, to me, that's kind of like the price of a mobile radio, a good dual-band mobile radio, and it's a good dual-band full-up repeater. And if you're putting it on UHF, you can get a pre-tuned duplexer, one of the flat packs that are common in UHF, for about $100, all tuned up out of China. So you're in $600 plus antenna and coax, and you can have a full-up repeater. So I bought one.
I just have a question. Is this repeater you're talking about the DR-1X?
Indeed it is.
Okay.
Is that System Fusion capable?
It is System Fusion, both digital and analog, and we can go into that a little more in a little bit.
Okay.
I looked at it, and I got my first one, and on the back was this high-density 15 accessory connector. For those that are familiar with a VGA connector on a computer monitor, it's the same connector. And I looked at the documentation, and looking at the various control options and the audio input and output on it, I said, you know what? I can make this into a D-Star repeater. And so having done some conversions on other repeaters, I figured that'd be kind of cool. So I mocked it up, and I used some sound cards and other devices I had around here to try some different modes to get it going. Once I convinced myself I could do it, I got with my fellow Northwest Digital Radio partner at who does our circuit design, and I said, you know, we could build a little circuit that would sit on top of a Raspberry Pi as a Raspberry Pi hat that would have all the components in it to do the modem to do D-Star. He says, I can design that. And so we designed it, and I actually have our alpha board running on a repeater here in the shack. I've actually had D-Star capable on these repeaters since almost a year now, but we wanted to get the design right. And as we looked further into it, we realized if we would just extend out, we could also put a Mini DIN 6 on the same board. And it could plug into any radio with the standard amateur radio 9600 baud packet connector on the back, and could be used for a variety of modes, packet, all of the amateur radio digital modes. It could actually be used for an analog repeater controller and so on. So that's what we've put together, and that's what we're planning to have available at Dayton. We'll probably release the product before then, but anyone going to Dayton should be able to drop by our booth and pick one up. So it is imminent. Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about what it does. It has a high-end sound codec chip on it. It's manufactured by TI. That particular chip has sample rates up to 96 kilohertz, which means we can get very high resolution data signal capture and also generate highly precise modem tones coming out the other end. And the nice thing about that is any other application, say Direwolf in the packet world, could up their rate and have a higher precision signal, which should allow for better detection at low signal levels and potentially higher baud rates within the channels that we typically allocate on one of the bands. So up in VHF, UHF. So it's really exciting from that point of view. The particular sound chip that we're using, the codec that we're using, there are some sources out there for that model number, but they're not really complete and they're not integrated well. So we put one of our developers on it, and we've written a real solid driver for it. And it happens to be the same chip that we're using inside the UDRX, our UHF radio that is software defined and band limited. So we'll be able to cross-fertilize applications between the two. They do use a different control bus in the two, but we're pretty excited about it. And a lot of the people we've talked to are pretty excited about it. So hopefully in a thumbnail, that's what it is. With the DR1X repeater, if you have the newer firmware that started being shipped after mid-December last year, you can run all three modes, Fusion Digital, Analog, and D-Star, all on the same repeater, and it will switch between the three on a per-transmission basis. And I've taken and hooked it up and put it on the busiest Fusion chat room and the busiest D-Star reflector and let them fight it out, and I haven't been able to lock it up, which is kind of nice. If you have the older firmware, you can do Analog and D-Star or Fusion Digital and D-Star. Yaesu, for the simple cost of you shipping the repeater to California, will upgrade the firmware so that you can run the newer version on it.
So this all sounds really exciting, but is this only for use in a repeater type scenario? I heard you talk about the 6-pin connector for regular ham radios. So is there another application besides a repeater application for this as well?
Absolutely. All of the digital sound card modes could be driven by it. So, you know, either us or someone else can port things like FLDigi or Direwolf or any of those and be hook those up to radios. I might mention that we're also doing our own Linux distribution for the Raspberry Pi for it. Basically, it's the Raspbian Jesse version with an overlay. We overlay the kernel and some drivers and some applications and so on. And we'll have that available where you can just do an APT get to upgrade from a standard Raspbian install to we call our version Compass to Compass, or we will make available preloaded images on SD cards for those that desire them.
All right, that's excellent. So the Raspberry Pi that this is a hat for, would that be the piece of hardware that would be running the FLDigi software?
Correct.
All right. So you can just have a standard Raspbian image or use your customized Raspbian image on the Raspberry Pi, which the UDRC is connected to. Then you'd have a full-blown computer that's sort of fully integrated with the functionality of the UDRC.
That is correct.
Oh, that sounds excellent. I know the price point on this is actually very attractive. I think I saw $89.95 is what you were going to ask for this.
Yes, including cables to hook it either to the HD16 or the DIN Mini DIN 6. There's also provisions for your own wiring through pads on the board or adding headers to put other connections onto it. But those were two that we felt people would make use of. But if you have a special application and you just need a really high performance audio codec on your Raspberry Hat, and you want to run off your own control signals from GPIO and audio, you can either use our connectors or your own simply by populating some headers that we have available.
All right. That's very cool. And I understand from what you said that it runs off the DR1X, and you can simultaneously repeat analog, D-Star, and System Fusion without interruption of any of those services.
Yeah, I get nervous when people say simultaneously because physics are involved.
Well, sort of in rapid sequence, perhaps.
Rapid sequence, that's the way to characterize it, yeah. So the same repeater can operate all three modes on a per-transmission basis.
Wow, that's amazing. That's really cool. I know my old amateur radio club that I'm still a member of up in Maine, they bought in on this DR1X promo. They asked the membership if everybody would, you know, chip in a few bucks here and there, and people jumped on it. They had the $500, I think, within a few hours, and they installed the DR1X probably 6 months ago. This sounds like something I need to get them to attach to it.
Well, I'd appreciate that. It can be addictive buying these repeaters. I now personally own three. and amongst the small team at Northwest Digital Radio, we either own or have access to another three or so. They have made a monumental increase in price through the end of June. You now have to pay $600, including shipping and taxes. So anybody that still wanted to get one of these to experiment with, if you have a club, and remember a club is four people, one of whom must have a ham radio license, you can order one. Or if you're an individual with a coordination either in hand or documentation that it's in process, they will sell it to you for that price direct from Yaesu.
That's good information. I didn't realize that the club thing only required one call sign. I remember it was a question on my amateur extra test.
Yeah, the rule says you must have four members. And if you're going to have a trustee, one of them has to have a license.
Excellent. So, John, the last time we talked to you, you talked to us about Northwest Digital Radio. That was back in episode 90. This is episode 166, so it has been some time. If you could remind us, we need to let others know who the other folks who are over there at Northwest Digital Radio putting out these great products.
Yeah, that'd be great. What we talked about back then, as I recall, is our UDRX, which is the 70-centimeter band-limited SDR. It's 25 watts, and it has gone through some evolution in the design since then, and we ran into some delays for a variety of reasons, which I won't go into. Last fall, we added another member to the team, Jeremy McDermott, November Hotel 6 Zulu, and it's been like putting an afterburner on the project, so we've been making a lot of progress through the winter on that design. Originally, we were designing our own single board computer to go in it because the Raspberry Pi really wasn't out yet. We have since modified the design to use the Raspberry Pi with the 40-pin connector, so that would be a 2 or a 3. What we ship with will depend on a couple of things. One thing with the 3 is it does have Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, which doesn't do you so much good when you're inside of a Faraday shield.
Right.
And we don't want it interfering with the main purpose of the radio. But we're doing lab experiments on that and seeing with if we just need to disable that or we can leave them enabled or whatever. Anyway, so that project's still moving forward, I expect we will have product out on that later this year. In the intervening time, we did develop a hat for the Raspberry Pi that has a DVSi Ambi 3000 chip on it. That chip is capable of doing the voice encoding and decoding for D-Star. Some of the Fusion modes, they're doing some interesting things with Fusion that we could discuss at another time, but some of the Fusion modes, the DMR mode and so on, and if you get around the intellectual property licensing issues of DMR, there are some people that are using them in applications in that area. We've also taken that and married with a Raspberry Pi. It uses the older, 24-pin standard or 26, whatever it was, which is upward compatible with the 40-pin. We marry those together and we create what we call an Ambi server, which is a server that can sit on your LAN or even the internet, and applications can access it to do Ambi encoding and decoding. Wrap that in the proper protocol, and you can get on one of the digital voice networks, whether it be D-Star or one of the others. Then we took that same basic design and put it in a USB stick. Looks like a thumb drive, so we called it the Thumb DV. We did that in part with a request from Flex Radio, the manufacturer of the high-end SDR radios, and they took it and wrote the software so that you can plug it into the back of their radio, which has USB ports, and do D-Star on the Flex Radio. And it's very popular on HF with that, and the models that have VHF, it's also used there. As far as the rest of the team, we have Basil Gunn, who is one of our developers, Dennis, whose last name I can never pronounce correctly. So Dennis, sorry about that, who is a world-class RF designer. And then Brian, who runs the day-to-day operations of the company and also does our circuit design and a lot of our electrical engineering. So that small team is working on all these products, and we've got others in the pipeline once we get the UDRX out.
All right. Well, very good. Like, I think we probably covered everything we need to know about the UDRC, and you said you should have some supply at Hamvention because you'll release it shortly before that, I assume.
That's our plan.
Well, that is good, and I hope I get a chance to visit with you up in Hamvention. I don't know yet if I'm going to be there, but if I am, I will definitely try and scope you out.
Well, certainly come by the booth. We probably will have some of our thumb DVs there as well, and some other things if people want to drop by.
All right, that sounds good. So, Rich, do you have anything to add to this? Are you still here, Rich?
I am. I have a totally unrelated question for John, if he's willing.
Well, it depends on what the question is.
It's like I always say, you can ask the question, just don't expect an answer.
I've noticed you've talked about AmperNet and Net44, and I'm just wondering, because URO Node has a new release, and I'm wondering if you can, in like five sentences, give us an overview of what it is.
I'm sorry, I missed what you said about the new release.
URO Node, Euro Node. I'm not sure how he says it. There's a new release of that. That's the N1 URO software that apparently runs on AmperNet. Am I saying that correctly?
Right. So I'm not particularly familiar with his code. Let me just give the short story of what's happening with AmperNet. Just 3 or 4 years ago at DCC in Atlanta, I got up and kind of gave the State of the Union on what had been happening with Net44. You know, we've had this fabulous resource of 16 million IPv4 addresses available to ham radio for over 30 years, and it kind of had been languishing. And so I presented several ideas there, including the notion that we really should move forward with technology and start using things, some standard solutions, instead of doing the normal ham thing, which is take something and figure out the hardest way to do it. you know, there'd been some advances in networking and so on, and suggested that it might be good to start interconnecting all of this IP address space directly on the internet. Traditionally, it had been a bunch of IP tunnels in a mesh formation, and you know, with dynamic IP addresses for the gateways and so on. It was constantly in a state of flux, and you never knew if something was going to be up or not. So I suggested maybe we should start moving towards things like BGP and putting segments of that network directly on the internet so they could be addressed directly, both in and out, and then, you know, use good firewall technology to protect assets and things that would actually go out over the air. Since that time, a number of projects have really kicked off. One of the big ones here in my area is HamWAN, the original, and then there's been a few other implementations around the country and the world that have been adopting their technology. They're using the 5.9 gigahertz ham band to build a microwave network with user access points and trunks into data centers. We've had a couple of big data centers here in the Seattle area that are donating bandwidth for interconnection with the rest of the internet. And using basically off-the-shelf higher performance Wi-Fi equipment, we're building this network out. Anyone that wants to learn a bit about it, go to hamwan.org. That's hamwan.org, and they have the specs for what they're doing and the maps of the nodes that are out there. And what's happened really interestingly with that is a lot of mountaintop repeater sites now all of a sudden have a microwave link back into the internet, for whether it be IRLP or D-Star or All-Star or Echolink or whatever, where they might have been paying a fairly hefty price for ISP service, WISP service, up to that mountaintop. They're now able, for the cost of the equipment, to join the network, which for an end node is, you know, less than $200. They're able to have a reliable internet connection using this resource from the AmperNet. So a lot going on. I suggest visiting amper.org and portal.amper.org You can get address space allocated to you, and there are facilities like HamWAN that will VPN tunnel to people that can't get direct BGP, and then BGP your segment out to the rest of the internet. So it's a way to build up the ham radio network. Of course, it only should carry ham radio related traffic, can't be used for commercial purposes, but it's a lot of fun to have that kind of capability available to people. And of course, if you're a Linux user, you've got all the tools you need.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, that was way more than
asking. You shall receive.
You've opened up this huge, like, it's not just a rabbit hole. It's like a, oh, I don't know. Anyway, I'll be delving into that, I guess.
It's a badger hole, is what it is.
It's a badger hole.
All right.
Well, maybe I gave you too much information, you know, a little TMI here.
Well, it's just interesting, you know, we think of the traditional, you know, packet nodes, you know, hooked to my 2-meter radio with my TNC, and and just so much has changed, and I've been looking into it recently, and there's all these different anyway, it's a little overwhelming right now.
Yeah. So, you know, tying this all back together, if you're tying repeaters using the UDRC or some other facility over that network to, you know, build these massive voice over IP networks, or you're using our UDRX to provide that last mile coverage where you can't get to it on microwave, or long haul coverage, I predict that we'll be able to do fairly high bandwidth, you know, 30, 40, 50 mile links, data rate. There are some limits because of the regulations. We've got to keep it in a 100 kilohertz channel on 70 centimeters, but we can pack a lot of bits into 100 kilohertz with some advanced modem techniques.
Very cool. Yeah, it's really fascinating. Yeah, and just, you know, just linking repeaters, you know, I think the way, how did you word it? Low latency repeater linking. I mean, that's, you know, that's worth it right there. So very cool.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're interested in digital voice standards for amateur radio, I did a talk at DCC last year. So if you look up K7VE DCC 2015, I have a pretty good discussion of the different standards and protocols and how they interact. So there's a wealth of information out there to help people to put together their own great ideas and expand them and move them forward. And I certainly encourage people to do that. And of course, the open source Linux world is where these things can happen. We can share with each other.
Absolutely. Russ, did you have anything else?
Honestly, I have nothing else. I mean, I'm sure we could open up all kinds of cans of worms and go on forever and ever, but I think we've touched on what we needed to touch on and probably a few things that we didn't, but that's all right.
Fair enough.
But I'm glad you were here, John. It's always great when you're on the show. We get a great deal of information out of you guys. And I know you have a blog over at kilo7victorecho.org and Northwest Digital Radio, I think is at northnwdigitalradio.com, I think is where you guys are at. All right. And is there anything else you want to say about, like, anything? I don't know.
Well, thanks for the invitation. I was glad that I could be here. We have a couple of discussion groups as well. You can find out about those through one of those blogs and websites, and encourage people to join us on those. With your permission, when this podcast is put up, we'll link to it from our site to give it some more promotion. And again, my sincere gratitude for the invitation to participate with you guys, and hope to see you at Dayton if you make it.
Well, you absolutely have permission to link back to us. That's no problem whatsoever. And I really appreciate you taking some time out on short notice to come here and talk about this. You know, it's nice to hear the information direct from the people who produce, you know, the products and the software and everything, because you obviously know it best, and that's where we want to get the information from. So I guess we'll let you get back to your regularly scheduled evening, and I hope we get a chance to talk to you on the show again real soon, and I do hope I get to visit with you at Hamvention.
All righty. Well, 73's to all.
All right. 73, John. Take care.
73, John.
All right. That was excellent. That was John Hayes from Northwest Digital Radio, Kilo 7 Victor Echo. Lots of information there about the UDRC. Lots of cool stuff, and if you're a repeater owner or you want to play around with cool technology and Raspberry Pis and all that neat kind of stuff, or just a tinkerer and have a radio that you can plug a 6-pin cable into, you can play around with that. And $90, pretty reasonable for an independently developed piece of hardware. So very cool.
It is it's very cool, which is why we had him on. I like their angle at the market. You know, they're not trying to control everything. They're like, here's a piece of hardware. Go have fun. You know, I like
well, that's sort of the ham radio way, right?
Absolutely.
And I was gonna complain about the whole Codec 2 thing and open source codecs and all of that, because the product they have is based on the Ambi chip. But the thing about the Ambi chip is you kind of need it for D-Star, so I completely understand why they went that way. And if you want your piece of hardware to integrate with D-Star, you have to be Ambi.
It was developed by hams, and it was kind of like, hey, maybe if there wasn't something available, maybe we should have waited or figured out if we could find something available instead of forcing the issue with the Ambi chip. Now, I don't know, is it supposed to come open soon or something? Anyway, and then the whole everybody's going a different direction. Oh, we're using Ambi, but we're implementing it differently, so it doesn't actually work. And then you know, you got guys like Northwest Digital who are like, well, I think we can make it work together. So it's really it's cool that they're able to do that.
I'll just interject that certainly the Codec 2 could be ported to both of these devices.
It wouldn't be useful for D-Star though, because it doesn't encode properly for D-Star.
Right. But if you wanted to build a Codec 2 repeater, you could use the UDRC. If you wanted to have an end radio, you could use the UDRX.
There you go.
John, I think a lot of the frustration that the regular hams feel, it's like, okay, wait a second. Oh, okay, we got this over here. I need a radio for that. And then we got this over here. And it's like, you know, nothing works with anything. And what do you buy? And it's tough. It's tough to get into any of this when you're automatically like saying, okay, I'm going to go over here with these guys, and we're not going to talk to you over there. Northwest Digital is trying to at least patch it together. I don't know why the manufacturers couldn't have done that in the first place. That's where the frustration comes from.
Yep.
Feel free to hang out and interject all night if you so desire. And we did, at the end of that last story, touch on AmperNet. So, Rich, you had some information here about AmperNet, so why don't you go ahead and work on that for a little bit?
I'm glad that John was able to shed a little light on it. This popped up, you know, I'm on those Debian lists, and URO node, I saw that. I'm like, oh, what is that? I've never heard of it.
Even after all that discussion, you still have no idea what you're talking about.
I have a better understanding of what it is. URO node is basically packet node software for Linux, and it's still being developed by N1 URO. And what I liked about this is he has written some scripts that will install it onto a Raspberry Pi, and that's kind of what really caught my eye, because, man, it made it simple. There's also a script that'll put it onto your desktop machine as well, and it just handles everything, and it looks for everything, and it's and then it tells you where you need to go. You know, you need to go fix these configuration files, and you need to go fix these configuration files, and he tells you where they are. I just thought it was a nice complete package there. The reason I was asking John about the AmperNet is because this URO node supports AmperNet and Rose and a bunch of other, I don't know what to call them, protocols perhaps that I never even really knew were out there. They're certainly not talked about. So that's why I went down the AmperNet road. And then I found out about the 44 block of our own IP addresses that nobody's using. And I know I've heard that that talk that John gave at last year's DCC, and I just didn't, I guess I didn't know what he was talking about. But it's really it's really neat. So anyway, this software is easy to put on, and I'm positive you could run a simple packet node using this software. That's all.
Oh, that's it?
Yeah. other than it's cool and it's being and it's still being developed. I didn't have enough time this week to really look into it. I did install it. Oh, here it is. URO node AX25, of course. OSI layer 4, and I'm not sure what that is, but NetROM and ROSE it supports, and then AMPR is that amper that we were talking about. FlexNet it supports, and then port, multi-port Digi. Yes, and I suppose that has something to do with maybe APRS. I'm not sure. But, you know, a lot of people think packet is dead, and obviously with APRS it's not. It might be a little complicated. But I just I don't want to see it go away because I think it's still a very useful mode for us amateurs.
One of the first digital things I did when I got into packet radio or when I got into ham radio was packet, and I still have an MFJ1294B. Is that
sounds right?
Is that even close? Packet TNC somewhere. I actually had that hooked up to a Radio Shack HTX202.
Yeah, that's the
that's the 2 meter handy talkie from Radio Shack. Yes, that's how I used to do packet radio. I don't somehow I don't think that is the right. Let me see, MFJ.
It's not a 1294, but I know it's close.
1292. I said 1292. I think that's what I said.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you might have. And while you're looking, I'll sing a little song about getting digital. Let's get digital, digital. I want to get digital. Let me see your waterfall, your spectrograph. I want to see your signals. Let's get digital. Okay.
Okay, it's an MFJ1270C connected to a Radio Shack HTX202. And that's how I did packet. And I have not done packet.
Look at that.
I have not done packet. And actually, the interface cable between my HTX202 and my MFJ1270C is the only piece of ham radio kit I have actually built myself.
Oh, nice. See, packet got you home brewing.
That's right. Back in 1992.
You know, I've messed with Direwolf. I installed Direwolf and then hooked up my Baofeng just to the mic port.
You hooked up your Baofeng? Sounds like a personal problem, but
my Baofeng radio. Yes, sir. And then there's a way to send the data from Direwolf, which is basically a sound card modem.
Right.
Sound card, yes.
Yes.
TNC. Yeah, I'm getting on.
Software TNC.
There you go. And sent it right over to Zaster, and things started popping up. It was the coolest thing. It was just awesome.
Popping up?
So it's popping up on the map.
Things are popping up all over the place?
And, oh, I should... I was getting so excited. So I'm also excited about this next topic, a brief tutorial on building software from source.
Okay, good. I'm glad we've got to this now so I can get through it and like take a break. But anyway, the reason I put this in here is because I got a question, and I can't remember if it was on Google Plus or not, but someone asked me, and I'm paraphrasing here because I don't have the information in front of me, but the basic question was, I heard on the show recently that you've been building a lot of packages from source as opposed from installing them out of the binary repositories. This is cool. My question is, if you're doing things that way, how do you uninstall a package if you've built it from source? And I was like, wow, that's a really good question. How do you uninstall a source-built package? Because if you're building things from the package repo, all you have to do is an app-get uninstall, and that pretty much removes everything. But if you're building something from source, maybe it's not so simple. So I thought I would take a little look at building things from source in general. If you want to install something from source, you obviously have to get the source. Well, how do you get the source? There's a couple of ways. You can go to a website like SourceForge or GitHub or any number of other places that will host a source package. Those source packages are usually in like TarGZ format or something like that. Basically, an archive of all of the source files that are necessary to build the package you want to build. So you have to download it as a tar.gz or a .zip file or something along those lines. It also happens that Debian and Debian-based distributions have source repos. You can download and install binary versions of your applications, which are already pre-built, and basically just involves copying the binaries onto your system in their appropriate locations, and then everything just sort of runs. Or you can app-get the source code for those applications, and then you have to build them. And then you can build them and then install them, and all is well. From a Debian perspective, if you want to install a binary package, you typed apt-get install name of package. If you want to install the source of a package, you type apt-get source name of package, and it will download the source of the package. Now, there are a couple of options you can specify to apt-get when you're downloading a source package. You can specify --compile or --download only, which is actually download-only. If you specify apt-get-compile source package, it will download the source information, and it will build that source information into a deb, a .deb. And at that point, you can just do a dpackage-i something.deb, and it will install the package. And that will be a source compiled package that you install in binary format. Now, you can also just say download only, and then you can build the package yourself. And there's a whole long list of things you need to do to actually build a source package in Debian, and this is really not sort of about that, because that would not be a brief tutorial on building software from source. That would be a lengthy tutorial on building software from source, and we're not about that right now. And like I said, you can also download a tar.gz or a zip file or something like that, and then you'll have a source package. And usually what you have to do at that point is you have to unarchive the package, which usually involves something like the unzip command or the tar command. Now, if you have a tar.gz file, for example, the options you would give to tar would be xzf, which is extract in gzip format the file, name of file. Pretty straightforward. If it was, for example, a tbz2 or a tar.bz2, that's an archive in bzip2 format, and you would specify tar xjf, name of file, and that will extract a bzip2 compressed archive into a source directory. This, of course, assumes that you have bzip2 and gzip libraries installed on your computer, and if you don't, that's a mere apt-get install of gzip and bzip2 away, so you have to have those in order for that to work. Once you've done that, you will have a directory which contains all of the source code for the project that you want to build, whether it be FLDigi or whatever it is that you have. In 99% of the cases, you will have to change directory into the top level of the new thing you just extracted, which will be like FLDigi or CQRLog or whatever it is, you know, the thing that you want to build. And there's a roughly standard method of building software that you can employ. Generally speaking, you'll have to do a configure, a make, and a make install. And what configure does is it runs through a script, and it checks your system to make sure that you have all of the necessary libraries and development packages installed on your system to properly build from source code. If the configure fails, it usually will error out with a message saying, you know, I couldn't find the gzip library, or I couldn't find the asound library, or something like that, in which case you'll have to install the necessary library or development package and then rerun the configure script. When your configure script actually gets through all of its steps and successfully and gives you a good exit code, then you can type make. Make will actually build your software. It will go through all of the C packages or Perl packages or whatever it is that you're building, compile them all together, and give you the necessary binary files that you need to run the application. And then you'll type make install. This instructs the make file to actually move those built binary packages or built binary files to the proper place on your file system so that you can execute them. You don't necessarily have to do this. You can execute them from the build location if you know where they are and what they're called. But generally, you want to move them into some place like user bin or user local bin that your system recognizes as a proper place to run an application out of. The idea then, maybe this is coming a long way around to the question of how to uninstall something, but anyway, it's kind of important to understand where the bits of these things that you've built actually wind up. When you're building something from source, generally speaking, the configure script will put all your applications in a top-level directory, which is /user/local. And what /user/local is for is a place where locally built applications get stuck. Things that are built out of the repos and installed in binary format usually go into just /user. So if you're installing FLDigi, for example, from the binary repositories, you will most likely find it in /user/bin/FLDigi. If you're building it from source, you will most likely find it in /user/local/bin/FLDigi. Is not necessarily the case because the configure scripts generally allow you to specify parameters. One of the parameters you can specify is the prefix. So you could say configure --prefix=/user and then go on from there. And then it would install FLDigi, for example, in /user/bin/FLDigi. And then you wouldn't necessarily be able to distinguish that particular installation of FLDigi from one that was installed from binary packages. So you probably want to specify a prefix of user local. And like I say, in most cases, if you're building from source, that's already specified. Not necessarily, but probably. You do your /configure --prefix=user local. It runs through. Everything looks good. You type make. It builds. Everything looks good. Type make install, and what make install does is it instructs the make file, which is just a script basically, to go through and move all of the newly created binaries from the build directory into the application run directory, which will probably be user local bin, user local s bin, something like that. Now we get to the point of uninstalling. So you've got all this stuff. If you've installed a program from source, all of these things are probably in user local. A good make file will have an uninstall option. So you can go into the source directory where you built the software, and you can type make uninstall. And if that works, then what it will do is it will go to the place where all of those source files were built and moved to, and simply remove them. And that's as easy as it gets for doing an uninstall. That may work, that may not work. If it doesn't work, then assuming that you have created your software in the user local directory, then usually you'll just have to go into /user/local and then some subdirectory like bin, sbin, lib, spool, var, something like that, and look to see where it put those binary files and simply remove them, you know, like an rm-f fldigi or whatever. And that's usually all it takes. Usually the binary files wind up in bin or sbin. Library files will wind up in user local lib. Some files might wind up in user local var. Some might wind up in user local lib. But that local directory is one where source built files generally wind up. And you can specify, like I said, in most configure scripts that user local is the root. That way you'll always be able to differentiate that you built this from source and it went into user local as opposed to something you installed from binary, which went into just user. Another place you can put these files is opt/opt. This is a great way to specify things you built from source because it is apart from everything else on the system. Anything, if you specify, for example, --configure --prefix=/opt, then everything will be under /opt, and you'll know that if you built this file and it doesn't work or whatever the reason is, you can just pretty much wipe out everything under opt and nothing on your system will be affected, just the stuff you built from source. I believe opt is a Sun Microsystems convention for third-party built software, but it still works today in all Unix and Linux systems. So /opt is a great place to put source-built software. Usually, in most applications, if you're building from source, if you do a .configure --help, the configure script will show you all of the options you can specify. But in every case that I've ever seen, as far as I know, --prefix is always an option. So user local and opt are great places to put source-built software, so you'll always be able to find them. And like I said, well-constructed make files will have a make uninstall option. So all you have to do is, once you've built it and install it, you can go into the build directory, type make uninstall, and it will just take the software out, and you're done. There can always be problems. You can have missing libraries. You can have missing development packages. There can be any number of reasons why your source project doesn't build properly, and that is way beyond the scope of what I'm talking about here. That is basically an overview of a couple of different ways you can build things from source, a couple of different ways you can get rid of things you've built from source, and some good conventions on how to indicate to your system and to yourself which software was built from source and which was installed from binary.
The first thing I had to do is go ahead and add to my repositories the deb sources for because I always uncheck them for some reason. I don't know why. And now maybe I'll start playing around with building from source. I didn't realize you could do it with apt-get. That's cool. So yeah, I manned apt-get. Apt-get source --compile, and you can build a package. That's just pretty cool.
This doesn't really mean a whole lot on most people's systems. It if you have a highly tuned system, if you have built a custom kernel that's built efficiently.
Oh, that's why you'd want to do it.
Right. Then you would
not
have
not just because you can.
Right. Not just because you can, but because that software will actually be built to the tuning parameters of your kernel. And for some low power systems or embedded systems, that might actually give you a performance advantage, but in a modern computing system, probably not, unless you're just a really super advanced user and this is the kind of thing you like to do.
Yeah, it's not me.
Right. So anyway, there's a really simplistic guide to building things from source. There's really a lot more to it, but that's the kind of two ways that things are done. And then, of course, sort of assumes that the package is built with a makefile and all that, because there are lots of other ways to do it. There are Perl scripts where you have to invoke Perl to create the makefile. There's like AutoMake, where you have an AC local file or an AC4 file that generates the makefile. Usually when it comes to building stuff from source, it's not a big deal because there is a help file, like a README file, that explains to you all of the steps you have to go through to build from source, and they try and make it easy as possible. I mean, it's usually not that difficult. The problem comes from when you actually go through their steps and something breaks in the middle, and unfortunately that's sort of beyond the scope of this little talk. So hopefully that will give you some insight into building from source by the apt method and by the source method, and also for install or uninstalling packages once you've built them from source. But with that, we probably should move on. We've got lots of feedback to get to. But before we get to that feedback, we have some music. And this music actually came from you, Rich. So you want to tell us about it?
It did. Jamendo, you can search Jamendo, and I was searching Jamendo for amateur radio terms like signals. Radio is tough because you get a bunch of stuff, but signals and Morse code. There's songs with Morse code in it, and they're hard to find. And I threw Antenna in there, and I came across a band called Antenna Trash, and this song is Chaotic by Antenna Trash, released in 2008. These boys are from Italy.
There's been some good open source or Creative Commons music come out of Italy, so we've played a few of them on the show.
I like the sound of it. Doesn't mean you will, but I don't care.
I actually have to say I previewed it a little earlier, and it sounded pretty good to me. So we're going to all hear it now.
Excellent.
All right, here we go. Chaotic from Antenna Trash. Chaotic. Pretty good. Punky. Punky lo-fi kind of stuff.
Let's get that. I don't know. That sound, it reminds me of like an 80s television show. anyway.
All right. Well, a good selection there. I enjoyed that, actually.
I hope everybody did. They were rocking out.
I hope so, too. I hope they were stomping their feet and swinging and hitting things and and breaking stuff and all kinds of good stuff. That's what you do to that kind of music.
Exactly. I don't know what they do in Kansas, though, and we got an email from Kansas.
They stand on tuna cans and look for the back of their heads. That's what they do.
That's right.
All right. This was from Steve, KD0IJP. Oh, by the way, we're in announcements and feedback. That's what we're doing here. This is some feedback, and he says, Russ et al., first, let me say that I have been listening to your show for about 9 months now, and I've gained a lot of good information. Thank you for your efforts. I have tuned into the live broadcast a number of times now as well. I've been poking around with the Debian Ham Radio Pure Blend distribution for a little while now. I learned about this from your show, and I think it's an interesting idea. I thought maybe I would share a couple of observations and ask a couple of questions. I think the idea of having a Linux distribution that comes preloaded with a bunch of ham radio software is a great thing. I also think it's great that this is supported by members of a mainstream distribution such as Debian. I hesitate, however, to give this to a Linux newbie. Now, if we had a distribution of Linux Mint, say, with all the ham radio software installed, then we'd really have something. So with that said, I have been exploring the idea of doing a basic Jesse install with my desktop preference, say, Cinnamon, and then installing the ham radio software using the meta packages that are maintained by the Pure Blend group. And this is something I actually addressed in the last episode. I believe that you said that one time you were doing this. This, however, has brought up a question that I hope maybe you can answer. The Pure Blend meta packages are not included with Jesse. Rather, they are archived in the testing distribution, Stretch. Despite my years of Linux use, I am not a Debian expert. I am a longtime Slackware user. Well, we forgive you. And so I'm wondering, what is the best way to use those meta packages with Jesse? Why do I feel like Casey Kasem? So I'm wondering, what is the best way to use those meta packages with Jesse? Should I add the testing distribution to the repository list and then apt-get install them? Will doing that end up install a bunch of testing packages on my system and make it less stable? And this is a long-distance request.
Is that the way Slackware users sound?
I don't know. All right, enough of that. Will doing that end up installing a bunch of testing packages on my system and make it less stable? Is it possible to instead download the meta packages from someplace and install them by hand? If so, where do you download them from? Thank you for any further insights that you can give me and keep up the good work. Thanks, Steve, KD0IJP. Well, cool. Thanks, Steve. And I have a great answer to your question. There is a concept in Debian called apt pinning, P-I-N-N-I-N-G, apt pinning. And what this allows you to do is have multiple distributions identified on your system and only install software from the repos that you choose based on a set of priorities. You basically pin a priority to a certain distribution or to any number of distributions on your system, and then software packages are installed based on that priority or based on a forced priority that you specify. There's going to be a link in the show notes to a great little tutorial that describes how apt pinning works, but here's the basic idea. You have a file /etc/apt/sources.list. And in that, you have a list of all of the repos you want to be able to install software from. You can specify in there or in sources.list.d by way of subfiles any number of distros. So you can have stable, testing, and unstable all specified in there. And then you configure in another file /etc/apt/preferences the priority for any of those distributions. There's a certain syntax to that, and that syntax is indicated in the tutorial that will be in the show notes. You give them a number-rated priority. For example, you can say that stable distribution is 700 priority, testing distribution is 650, and unstable is 600. Whatever the highest number is the highest priority, so if you don't specify, you will get packages from the highest priority distribution, which in that particular case would be stable. Then you do an apt-get update, and it updates your system with packages from all of the distributions that you have specified in the priority order that you have also specified. Now, the nice thing about this is there are two ways to then install packages on your system. So let's say that your system is based on Debian Jesse, which is 8 stable, and you have given that the highest priority. Then if you do, for example, an app-get freedv, it will install by default from the repo with the highest priority, which will be stable. Now, there are two flags you can give to app-get to alter this behavior. The first one is to say app-get install freedv / and then the name of the distribution, for example, unstable. What that will do is it will attempt to install the freedv package from the unstable distro and attempt to satisfy the dependencies of that package from your high priority distribution. And I hope I'm making this clear because it's kind of important. So what it will attempt to do is install the freedv package, for example, from unstable, but satisfy its dependencies from stable, or whatever your highest priority distribution is. If it can't do that, it will fail, and it will tell you why. This is important because you were asking about whether if you do the meta packages, will it just install a bunch of crap out of testing or unstable onto your system that you don't necessarily want. If you use this method, it will not, but it may not necessarily work because the package's dependencies may not be satisfiable by the younger or lesser distributions. The other option is to specify a -t option, app-get-t unstable. The t takes a distribution argument, install name of package. And what that will do is it will install the package from the distribution that you specify and attempt to satisfy its dependencies from that same distribution, which should pretty much always work. But it may incorporate into your system a lot of packages that are dependencies from that other distribution, creating a lot of extra packages on your system. But it shouldn't necessarily work. What you could do is you could have a Jesse install. You could set up your pin priorities. You can include stable and testing as available distributions. Set stable with a higher priority, testing with a lesser priority. And then do app-get the name of the meta package from the Debian Ham Radio Pure Blend / testing, because you want to specify where the meta package actually is. So what it will try and do is install the meta package from the testing distribution and satisfy its dependencies from the stable distribution, which again may or may not work. But if it does work, then you have accomplished your goal. You have the Debian Ham Radio Pure Blend installed on Jesse, even though you're not actually running Squeeze or the testing distribution. And again, all of this information is laid out really well in this particular tutorial. It's short, it's easy to get through, it explains everything you need to know, and that information, or at least a link to that information, will be into the show notes if I didn't properly explain it to you. Rich, did that make sense to you?
Well, it did, but only because I have apt pinned before, and it's not easy. To do.
It's conceptually a little weird. I understand that. But if you happen to get the hang of it, it is a wonderful mechanism for installing software from a version of the repositories that you are not necessarily running without having to upgrade your entire system to that particular version of the repositories.
Well, here's what I do. You want to know what I do?
What do you do?
I'm a Synaptic Package Manager user. And I authenticate, and then I go to settings repositories, and I open that big thing up. And then where it says, I'm on Jesse. So I'll go to Deb Jesse, and I will just change Jesse to Stretch. And then I will click OK, and then I will hit update, which updates the repositories. And then I very carefully, you got to follow the steps. Only install what I wanted to install from Stretch, which would be the ham radio pure blend stuff, which is ham radio antenna, ham radio task cell, tasks, ham radio tools. When I'm done installing that, then I go back to the repositories. I click on the one that said stretch. I change it back to Jesse. I click OK, and then I click reload. Reload. I said update. It's actually reload, and then that will reload the apt cache with the Jesse data. Does that make sense?
Yes.
The problem is if you click mark all upgrades while you've got all the stretch loaded up in there, you're
you're going to have stretch, and you may have a broken system. Yes,
you're going to have a broken system. More than likely, you'll have a broken system. So you can do it that way, where you change the repositories, only install what you want. And I've done that successfully with some software, but you can get into a situation where it's like, oh, this dependency isn't satisfiable. You know, it's not the correct version. So you go ahead and you put the stretch version in, and then it breaks something on your Jesse machine.
Yep.
So you kind of got to be careful with the dependencies.
Yes, you absolutely have to do. And the probably the biggest caveat when it comes to installing things from repositories in general is trying to back out of or fix a broken dependency problem, because sometimes it's easy and sometimes it is not. I've actually had dependency problems that were only fixed by a reinstall.
Oh yeah, and that's what. Well, that's the joy of Linux.
If you want to call it
that. That's the joy of GNU/Linux.
Yes, absolutely. But we won't harp on that too much. Anyway, that link will be in the show notes. You've got a couple of ways to do it. It's not as difficult as it sounds. It really isn't. It's just a couple of lines of config file, and I believe you can have the system you're looking for. So. And if you have any further questions, you know, don't hesitate to hit us up and we will do our best to answer them for you.
Yes, we will.
All right, moving on to something that's a little bit easier to deal with. We have a message from John McGrath over on Google Plus. He said, new format for the podcast? Why, yes, John, there is. While I enjoy the idea of quick stories regarding ham radio and Linux, I also enjoy the in-depth segments discussing software and issues. Thanks again for a great podcast. Well, you probably are going to love this episode because it's kind of full of both. So thanks anyway for the feedback. We appreciate that. We also got a comment on episode number 163 from Jeremy, Kilo Delta 5, Hotel Quebec, November, who says, I don't see the Green Country Hamfest on your calendar events. Are you going to have anyone there? Come on, Russ. Surely you can make it from your little corner of Southwest Missouri down to Claremore for an awesome ham fest. And to which I replied to Jeremy, yes, we're going to be at the Green Country Ham Fest, and don't call me surly. I don't think this episode will actually be out before this weekend, which is when the Green Country Ham Fest actually is. And there's only, as far as I can tell, one person in the chat room listening to us right now, who is Victor Alpha 7. X-ray Mike. So he's the only person who's going to know that Cheryl and I will be at the Green Country Ham Fest in Claremore, Oklahoma on April 8th and 9th, 2016, except for those people who actually also go there. Anyway, we hope to see you there. And yes, Jeremy, we will be there. And like I said, don't call me surly. He actually did say surly.
Surly.
Yep, that's what he said. Surly.
Yeah. Green Country Ham Fest. It sounds so quaint.
It is, as I have come to understand, the largest ham fest in Oklahoma. So,
really?
Really. Claremore, Oklahoma is just northeast of Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's a two-day ham fest from 4 to 9, I believe, on Friday, and 8 to 3, if I'm not mistaken, on Saturday. And Linux in the Ham Shack will be there. So hopefully we get to see
it's
all
the same place until last year. It's in 3 days.
Yes, it is.
Holy mackerel. That's fantastic. That's great. It's the biggest and the best in Oklahoma. You want to know what the grand prize is?
What's the grand prize?
FTDX 3000 from Yaesu. It's the rig of choice for the 2016 GCHF. Oh, that would be the Green County Hamfest. Holy mackerel. They got great prizes. A DX3000, an FT991, that's an HF rig, an FTM400 XDR, that's that dual band VHF, UHF. Wow! Those are good prizes, way better than the ones in Colorado. Let's move on.
All right. Thanks, Jeremy, KD5HQN, and I know we will see you out at the Green Country Ham Fest coming up this weekend. So moving on, we've got a really long bit of feedback from Johnny, November 4, Juliet Echo Kilo, and I'm going to try and get through this as fast as I can. So here we go. He says, I know I'm a bit late in posting this. I have just been so busy as of late, as have we, that I have not been able to listen to you folks for a while. I go away, and now you have a completely different co-host. Welcome, Rich.
Yay.
Hi.
To the show, and I must say I have enjoyed listening to you. I think you'll make a pretty good co-host if you can handle it. Russ must be a real taskmaster because he can't seem to hold on to co-hosts very long.
Well, that is true.
Ha ha ha. Just kidding. To comment on some of these topics this week, I would say if you are sensitive to RF, move to so-called RF dead zones or wear chainmail and or a suit of armor. Sad state of affairs for both SourceForge and Linux Mint. To be a tablet or not to be a tablet, that is what all the phones and laptops say. Tablets are interesting, but I think people want them to be like laptops that fit in your pocket, but manufacturers just don't get it. Anyway, good luck to Ubuntu. Most tablets have not done well in the market, even Apple's iPad. Now, I just don't understand why anyone wanted to use Windows. Do like the Russians do, and dump Windows while you can. I have heard that Microsoft is doing forced upgrades to Windows 10. If you can imagine working away and the auto update pops up and tells you that it's going to patch your PC, you think nothing about it and let it do its thing. It then says it has to reboot to complete the update, so you let it reboot. You go get your coffee, take a break while your machine is rebooting and applying the patches. You get back to find out that you now have to log into Windows 10, but when you left, the machine had Windows 7. This is crazy, but that is exactly what is happening. So I don't mean to rant, but I too was surprised a few years ago when I got my ham license to find out that most software for hams are window-based and not open source for us hams that like to tinker. So I've made it my mission to hunt down software that is open source for hams to use it, and it is because of this and a few other podcasts and blogs that I can now do everything that Windows hams could do, but using either Linux or FreeBSD. I plan to start building tutorials for these apps and sharing them. Anyway, I'm going to cut this post short, or perhaps long, since it is already too long to read on air, but I read it anyway. But I want to thank you guys for all your hard work. There'll be a link in the show notes to the Computer World article about the forced Windows 10 upgrades. And if you want to do tutorials in the open source world, you might want to talk to Matt, KD9BWJ. I believe that's the right call sign.
That's right, yeah.
Who is doing that at openfosstraining.org. He would probably love to have your assistance on putting those tutorials out there. So thanks anyway. Johnny always has great feedback and lots of it. Call sign again, November 4, Juliet Echo Kilo. Whew.
One more.
All right. We also had a Facebook message from Darren King, who says the Hills Amateur Radio Group, HARG, H-A-R-G, have their ham fest real soon. That's Sunday, April 17th. And you can find out more information about the HARG Hamfest at www.harg.org.au for those of us lucky enough to be anywhere near Australia. That's cool. Thanks, Darren, for that bit of information. And now I get to shut up for a minute and we get to listen to Cheryl talk about some cool desserty type stuff.
Woohoo!
Yay!
Yeah, I've not been doing many desserts here lately, so I found this recipe today and I thought, ooh, that sounds good. So anyway, today's recipe is for tiramisu cheesecake. I love tiramisu. Russ has not been a terribly big fan of it.
Mezzo.
Well, that was also before you're drinking coffee. You might be a little more favorable right to it now. But because we live in rural Missouri, you can't find ladyfingers, which is a necessary component of tiramisu, anywhere. So, you know, rural area, no ladyfingers, not making tiramisu around here. But this recipe does not use ladyfingers. It actually uses vanilla wafers. So, I am very intrigued by this. I have not made it, of course, but...
What do you mean, of course?
I have not made it, of course. You just said 2 seconds ago that we are busier than one-arm paper hangers.
Well, you don't want to let people know that you don't make these recipes.
I have not made this one yet. Your parents will be here in a few weeks. Guess what's going to be for dessert
one night?
We're
going to have tiramisu cheesecake. Yep. All right, there we go. Sounds good.
So, anyway, it uses vanilla wafers, instant coffee granules, some hot water, cream cheese, sugar, sour cream, eggs, whipped topping, and which would be Cool Whip for most of us, and some baking cocoa. And you whip that all together and make yourself a little tiramisu cheesecake, which sounds wonderful right now. So,
well, I don't know. I'm not a big sweet fan anymore. I grew up on sweets, and now I think I'm kind of over it. But
could that be because I bake cakes?
Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, there's tubs of buttercream in the refrigerator, and you're just, used to, you're in it with a spoon, and now you're just like, bleh, buttercream.
Can't do it really much anymore. So, oh well. But all of the instructions on how to put that tiramisu cheesecake will be in the show notes. You can find that on Cheryl's website, too, if she ever gets around to updating it.
I've had so much stuff going on here.
I know.
Lately.
One more of those things to do. Anyway. Yeah, we're kind of in between concerts tonight. Last night we saw John Mellencamp. Tomorrow we're going to see Mumford and Sons.
Next Friday we're seeing ZZ Top. And then 2 Fridays after that, it's The Who.
So we got all kinds of stuff going on.
And then your parents will be here, right after that.
Then we've got a ham fest in between there, and we got Hamvention somewhere along the line. And
Poker and Cards Against Humanity and karaoke.
And, we don't have a moment to ourselves. But anyway, we're going to move on to the social media roundup. So let's round up some social media.
Oh, that means I got to scan down to that part.
Yep, it sure does.
I was so hoping to get out of that.
Nope.
What, because I've skipped the whole night tonight?
Yep, pretty much.
Uh-huh. All right, fine. Okay, so for our donations and subscriptions category, we have Jonas Arullo, Jeremy Hall, Michael Connolly, Harrison Kyle, Scott Pettigrew, Bob Yerke, Paul Griffith, Ronald Ikey, Johnny Kinsey, Brian Smith, John Spriggs, Robert Halliday, Ben Schramm, Michael Aiello, John Clark, Rob Branch Dash, Edward Donnelly, Donald Gover, Alan Wilson, and down some Stephen Sainer, Dylan Engel, Jason Marinaro.
Marinaro,
whatever. I get that wrong every week.
Yeah, you'd think you'd learn.
Yeah, no. Old dog, no new tricks. Ronald Nesler, James Blocker, Doug Redder, Michael Lasky, Darren King, Petra Kartsakis. Yeah, sorry, Petra. Donna Farron and Gary Horlick. I need a bigger laptop. On Facebook this week, we had Humberto Toval, Sylvain Descoteau Du, Robert Lee, and Brian Sim. Google Plus was Jonathan Straub. Twitter was at Ben Landis, at HB9FXQ, at SM0RUX, and at KC9YJP. Nobody joined us on YouTube. Nobody. Oh, no. We did have somebody on the mailing list. Yay. Kirk joined us this week. Yay.
Yay, Kirk. Woo. And you know who you are.
And only you know who you are. And there was no merchandise sales this week.
He could be my ex-brother-in-law.
Ooh.
But I don't know.
He could also be Kirk Douglas, but I'm betting against it.
If it's your ex-brother-in-law, maybe he's stalking you.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Are you scared yet? And that HB9, he's from Switzerland.
Sorry, I hit the button again.
Stop pushing buttons.
This episode is already going to be a double episode, and that's after I edit it, so...
Well, that's okay, so you don't have to do one next week.
Or week after next. It doesn't really work that way, so...
You could say, this episode will be continued next time.
To be continued. Yeah. I don't think that. But anyway, I'm going to push the button. That means you're going to hear some music, and there it is, and we're going to get on out of here. So thanks, everybody, for tuning in to this really, really long episode of Linux in the Ham Shack, number 166. You can become an LHS ambassador. Visit the website for upcoming events and information on how you can represent Linux in the Ham Shack at a nearby LinuxCon or Ham Fest. We love feedback. You can email us at info@lhspodcast.info, comment on an episode on the website, post on Google+, Facebook, or Twitter, or leave a voicemail at 1-909-LHS-SHOW. That's 1-909-547-7469. Visit our IRC channel, Octothorpe LHS Podcast on Freenode. Subscribe to our mailing list. You can get show merchandise from coffee mugs to t-shirts at cafepress.com/LHS Podcast. You can also help out the show by clicking on the sponsored ads in the right-hand column of the homepage. Listen to us live every other Monday night at 8 o'clock Central Time. That's Tuesdays at 0100 Zulu. During daylight savings, it's 0200 Zulu when it's not daylight savings. Our recording schedule and countdown timer to the next episode are on the website. Check out our website at lhspodcast.info for everything you ever wanted to know about the show. Thank you to all of our listeners live, quasi-live, past, present, and future. We appreciate every single one of you. Again, this has been episode number 166 of Linux in the Ham Shack. And from Studio 3D in Southwest Missouri, I'm Russ, K5TUX. That over there is Cheryl.
Good night, everyone.
And from somewhere out in the wilds of Colorado is Rich, KD0RG.
7-3, everybody. Have a fantastic couple of weeks.
And we'll see you in a fortnight's time, minus a day. Hope everyone has a great time. Catch you then.
Lost my place.